That was my son Ari when he was one. He was just learning how to talk. What's amazing about small children picking up language is how effortlessly words and names seem to come to them. But what happens when someone doesn't learn language until they're an adult? It happens more often than you might think, especially in developing parts of the world. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're listening back to a story about Kansas Cityans learning a language for the first time. The story comes to us from Ari's dad, my husband, Alex Smith.
So in Bhutan, I was really young. I think I was 7 years old.
Maita is a refugee from Bhutan. Starting in the late 80s, the Himalayan country began driving out people like him who were ethnically Nepali. They fled across the mountains to Nepal, where they were settled in impoverished camps.
I didn't even know Nepal. I didn't know anything about it.
I should explain, the voice you're hearing isn't actually Maita's. It's Jampi Biswa, who's also a Bhutanese refugee. Maita is deaf and told his story using sign language for Jampi to voice. Maita and some of the other refugees in this piece asked me not to use their last names. The countries where they lived, Bhutan and Nepal, have some of the highest rates of deafness in the world. Many people in this region lose their hearing because of a lack of basic health care to treat common ear infections, high fevers, and measles. There's also a stigma surrounding deafness, and it's common for deaf people to be kept out of public life by their families.
Some who could talk had a better life. It was different if you are deaf.
Like many deaf people in the region, Maita says he didn't go to school growing up, so he didn't learn sign language, reading, or writing. Deaf people were often stuck using informal hand gestures with friends and family and had no other way of communicating. When the Bhutanese government started pushing out the Nepalis, Maita's parents fled without him and his sister.
My other brother went with my parents, but me and my deaf sister, we were on our own.
Maita ended up living in a refugee camp in Nepal for 20 years before coming to the U.S. He eventually settled in Kansas City.
Actually, we can go around the room and they can practice. That's Dao. Her name, D-A-O, Dao.
In a small house in Kansas City, Kansas, Debbie Buchholz teaches a weekly American Sign Language class for deaf refugees. Buchholz is pastor of Deaf International Community Church. Her dozen students are almost all Bhutanese refugees. They sit in a circle of couches and watch her use sign language to introduce a new student. Dao is a woman in her 40s who looks terrified. She's a refugee from Vietnam, but her situation is similar to the others.
She has never been to school, the same as you. No school. She doesn't know sign language, nothing. You are her friends, and you know what to feel like. Refugee, you know, hard.
With their teacher's help, the class members show me how to sign their names. Maita, Guman, Don, Harka.
My name is H-A-R-K-A.
Harka, so two fingers on the right of the forehead.
On the right
of the
head.
Okay.
Or at least they try to teach me. It's tricky to make the hand signs, and I get the positions mixed up. American Sign Language also has sophisticated grammar and vocabulary, but what these students are doing, learning it as a first language as adults, is really hard. And scientists are just starting to understand why.
Are you ready for your walk?
Yeah.
Can you say hello?
Hello.
That's my son, Ari. He's starting to learn his first language. He's saying some first words, mama, dada, hello, bye-bye. His mom and I sometimes try deliberately to teach him certain words or phrases. We ask again and again questions like, is that a tree? Can you say tree? He probably thinks this is ridiculous, and he might be right. Rachel Mayberry of the University of California, San Diego, says our lessons probably aren't needed. All it takes for a young child to learn a language is to be surrounded by people using it.
Children themselves, in an unconscious process that we don't quite understand, are able to, through this barrage of talk that they hear, to figure out the grammar of language.
But this magic window of language learning only stays open for so long. Rachel scans the brains of language learners and says certain areas seem evolved to process grammar. But if they aren't used by age 9 or 10, they start to shut down.
Although they're specialized for language, we see that for them to become fully operational or fully functional or fully wired, so to speak, that actually requires this early stimulation.
Still, for adult first-time language learners, the brain finds a way. It recruits other parts of the brain that normally process space and visual information to work double duty as language areas. These late language learners usually don't or possibly can't use complex sentence structure or abstract vocabulary. They would probably never use a sentence like this one that has a dependent clause or use a word like linguistics. But Rachel says they do have some advantages. When a child like my son Ari is first learning a word, say, hot, he's learning both the word and the concept at the same time. Adult learners already know the concepts, so they can pick up vocabulary really quickly.
There is this recognition of, oh my gosh, everything has a name. Oh my gosh, I can put these concepts together. So teaching language and learning language for these deaf individuals who are learning language late is a very important and life-changing event for them.
In the sign language class in Kansas City, the more advanced students practice their new language skills by telling stories. Most are in their 30s, 40s, or 50s, but this is the first time they've been able to tell others about many of the heartbreaking experiences they lived through.
It was so hard, so painful, and so hard to trek through the mountains. There was cold and snow. You couldn't walk on the snow because you could fall and be killed.
Men would stand in the forest and hide, and they would say, come in here, come in here. They wanted to rape the women, and we would say, no, no, and run away. We were so afraid because they wanted to rape us and then kill us.
In the refugee camps, we had all these tents, and the elephants would come in at night hungry. The elephants crossed people's heads and stepped on their bodies and tore their bodies apart.
Cobras would come in into camp, and it was scary. See, I was a little girl. I grew up in the refugee camp. I didn't even know there was another place other than this camp.
As Debbie watches her students sign, she slowly shakes her head and tells them, I'm sorry, I'm sorry.
I'm happy that you are here safe. I'm happy.
She wants her new students to eventually use their new language skills beyond the classroom, so she takes them on field trips, like a recent trip to the grocery store.
Come on, let's go in.
Let's go.
The class steps past the automatic sliding doors, and they look stunned by the aisles of bright food packaging, the bins of fresh produce, and the rush of lunchtime shoppers. Many of them spend all day inside their apartments, so an outing like this is a big deal. The new student, Dow, stares nervously at the ground.
Honeydew melon, where? I'm looking, she said, I'm looking.
Debbie sends her students on a scavenger hunt to find certain foods and learn their names. They seem to light up as they come across familiar foods like yucca root that they knew from Bhutan and Nepal.
That's cantaloupe.
Their excitement about learning is obvious, but Debbie says it doesn't always translate to new language skills. Because they're late to language learning, sometimes the lessons just don't stick. Some of the class members can go for months without any progress. Others never seem to get it.
It's so discouraging that I, at times, get angry. And I don't know who to be angry at. It's like every human being that is born in this world has this right to be able to express their wants and their needs. And when I work with people that can't express it, I get very frustrated. They found salad dressing. I'm so happy.
But she's always looking for signs of hope. And on this field trip, Dow shows promise. Something seems to have clicked for this woman who seemed so lost. Within an hour, she's practically chasing her teacher through the aisles, pointing and demanding to know the names for things like melons, cabbage, and carrots. What's more amazing is she's signing the names back. Suddenly, it's not hard to imagine her shopping at a place like this on her own and finding her place in this community. Debbie says she recognizes teaching Dow and other class members may take years, and even then, they may never have real fluency. But that's not the point of the classes.
No matter what statistics say, I know that they're out there and I understand all that, but I believe in not giving up, and I believe in giving them something that they can use to have a voice in this world.
For now, Debbie and her students are taking on new language one class at a time.
KCUR's Alex Smith brought us that story. And the people he introduced us to, the ones learning sign language, faced persecution in their home countries that kept them from learning to communicate through language before now, which is totally mind-boggling, but the U.S. has its own history of discrimination when it comes to the non-hearing population. The sign language teacher we just met has a personal perspective on that history, which we're going to hear about now. Reverend Debbie Buchholz, good morning.
Good morning.
You grew up with this history in your home.
I did. My parents are deaf, and aunts, uncles, cousins, children. We have hereditary deafness in our family. Only 13% of deafness is hereditary, and we have hereditary deafness in our family.
And you yourself, you obviously can hear, but you struggle with it a little bit yourself. We're sitting positioned so that you can see my mouth while we're talking.
Yes, I'm hard of hearing. I carry the gene that my family has, and I am hard of hearing. I have severe word discrimination. I can hear sounds easier than I can understanding speech. So I am a lip reader, yes.
Did discrimination and inequality shape your parents' experience of deafness? In any way that you could witness in your house or heard about from them?
Well, actually, I grew up hearing stories from my parents for many years, all of us, all five of us kids. And my parents had so many stories that they told about what had happened to them at the deaf school, what it was like for them to grow up in families who didn't use sign language in the home.
And can you explain that? Why weren't they using sign language in the home?
So my father's parents were German speaking only. And during that era, my father's born in 1925, deafness here, even in the United States, was considered a curse. It was considered something very negative. The family had sinned, and so this child is born deaf. And so sign language wasn't a beautiful thing during that time, and to have a deaf child was not something you were proud of.
So the idea being that it was that making that invisible was important?
Was very important. My father would tell stories about people coming to the family farm to visit, and he would see one of his parents running at him to grab him and his deaf brother and put them in a closet to hide them. He said he didn't have a clock. He didn't know exactly how long he was stuck in that closet, but he said it was hours and hours, and he does remember sleeping overnight in that closet.
The deaf school that you mentioned that your parents went to, that you heard stories from there, what kinds of stories came from that experience?
So many stories. During the time that my mother too, she was born in 1935, so there was a 10-year gap there. They entered the school during those years. They had what was called an oral method of education. And so the teachers were not allowed to use sign language, and the students, they could be hard of hearing to profoundly deaf, had to sit and receive the lesson by watching the teacher's mouths. And so he would tell stories about how both my parents loved learning and loved education and had dreams of going to college. Neither one of them did. But he would tell stories about how if they were caught signing, their hands were beaten, they had to kneel on broomsticks, what kind of tools were used in their mouths in speech class, trying to get them to be able to speak. And my father is profoundly deaf. He has zero hearing. And so speaking was not something that he was able to do.
Is hearing stories like this part of what inspires you to work with people whose own inability to hear has in some way shut them out?
Definitely. I spent my whole life, since I have hearing and I'm the eldest daughter, I was ordained the family interpreter. And so I had to interpret for my parents to the whole world and for the world to my parents. And so I went with them through all of the experiences that they had that were related to discrimination and oppression. And I'm different now. In my 20s, I was very angry and on every protest committee out there. But today,
protest committees, like, there are movements,
yes,
in this country. There have been,
yeah,
fighting the kind of discrimination you're talking about.
Yes. And, well, for example, just trying to fight the world in looking at my parents and my aunts and uncles and my cousins in the deaf community, fighting the world to get them to look at them as equals, as people who have a right to have a voice, to express themselves, to receive a proper education, to be able to get married and have a family, or go to college, or to have what everyone else has. It was that kind of fight that I have been involved in my whole life.
What's your understanding of how the kinds of experiences your parents had and your aunts and uncles and so much of your family over time has, what that has to do with history with a capital H in the United States? Do you think that what your parents have experienced represents policy issues or major chapters in history that the hearing community doesn't know very much about?
Well, I think there's a lot. I think that as time goes by, when we're doing all of this fighting, when a minority group is doing all this fighting, trying to get the world to listen to us, trying to find a voice in society, it influences a lot of different areas: education, laws, policies, rights. And I think that it is important for minority groups to continue to fight and to be a voice in the world, and because it does influence history and it does shape our future.
Can you give me an example? You talked about being in your 20s and being out there in protest groups. Can you give me an example of something specific you were protesting at one point?
Yeah, I was involved in a lot of protests in fighting for equal opportunity for education. I grew up hearing these stories from my parents on how they were mistreated, how they were denied, how I have a story of my father who talked about going to college. And when it was time for him to graduate, he was 20 years old, and he was a star student.
In spite of having to lip read,
yes. Well, he was a star on the football team and a captain and homecoming king. Right, in spite of. And he wanted to graduate and go to college. And when it was time to graduate, he was told that he wasn't going to graduate. And they never told him why. And I listened to that story throughout my whole childhood. And when my son Noah was deaf, and we moved to this deaf school so that he could attend the school, I asked the superintendent if he could investigate it, and he did. They found his records in the attic, and stamped on the first page was denied graduation because he couldn't speak. And so when they found those records, he was 68 years old, and they gave him his diploma, which was nice, but it did not give him the opportunity to go to college, not at 68.
Yeah, it didn't go back and erase all of those years.
No, it did not.
When you were out there fighting, what were you fighting for specifically?
Specifically to make sure that the teachers who were teaching our deaf children were fluent in American Sign Language, that they understood deaf culture, that a deaf child could go to school and learn something and grow and be educated properly so that they can go to college if they want to.
Debbie Buchholz, stay with me, okay?
Okay.
I'm Gina Kaufman. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll hear from an expert on the history of the deaf community's struggle for equal rights. That's coming right up. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're getting a window into a movement for equal rights in this country that a lot of us don't know much about, rights for people with deafness. It turns out there is a whole history there, and we're going to talk about it now with William Ennis. He's a professor of history at Gallaudet University in Washington, D.C., and he himself is deaf, so you'll hear a bit of a lag for an interpreter between my questions and his answers. Hi, William.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. What interests you about the history of deaf people in the United States?
That's a good question. Both of my parents were deaf. I'm from a deaf family. And my father was very into history generally, and I think that really touched me. And I was participating, listening to your conversation with Debbie, and it was interesting to me the difference between her experience and mine. I'm from a deaf family, big deaf family, and both of my parents went to college. My mother went to graduate school. So our experience was very different in that, and the stories that she got and that I got were very different. So you can see how much education can actually have an impact on deaf lives, and it's really critical. And I thank Debbie for all of her advocacy and protest work. It's really important.
You know, when it comes to this history, it seems like it's hard to avoid the name Alexander Graham Bell, who most of us know as the inventor of the telephone, which sounds innocent enough. But what was Alexander Graham Bell's relationship with the deaf community?
So he not only invented the telephone, but he had a very interest and involvement. He was a strong supporter of oralism, and not only oralism, but also eugenics. And my research looked at how those two really overlapped. They're not necessarily mutually exclusive, but there is some overlap in how they had an influence on one another. So at the beginning of deaf education in the United States in roughly 1817, sign language was accepted, it was appreciated, and used in all schools in America. And it wasn't until about 1840 or 1850 that oralism actually emerged, and that also kind of coincided with the eugenics movement. And the two of them would then kind of feed each other to really oppress deaf education in the sense of banning sign language.
Why was Alexander Graham Bell concerned about this?
His family had a history of, at that time it was called elocutionist. So his grandfather in Scotland and Britain worked in that field. So it was somewhat natural that he would be involved in that as well. So he had always been focused on speech and how we learn speech and writing system of learning how to speak appropriately. So it wasn't surprising that he was involved.
The word eugenics is probably familiar to a lot of our listeners, but oralism maybe not. Can you explain that word and that movement?
Sure. So generally speaking, there are two types of education for deaf children. One uses sign language, and the other is oralism. That basically means using speech and training deaf children to speak, physically speak, and to speech read. And that's historical model and has evolved somewhat with the advances of technology, cochlear implants, and that's helped that model somewhat. But generally in history, there are those two options. And where oralism and eugenics intersect is that sense of normalcy. Attempting or pushing so everything you can do to make a deaf person fit back into hearing society.
How is that harmful to deaf people?
The deaf community, the deaf world would argue that deaf culture is a part of the inherent, it's an inherent part of a person. Signing is a natural way for deaf people to speak. And for everything from that language of sign through the culture, the traditions, is all intertwined. For us, normalcy means signing and being visual. Forcing deaf people to use, or, well, first of all, to set aside their sign language and accept speech and lip reading, that forces or that pressure to fit into normalcy has a long history of oppression, and not just for deaf people. You can look at African Americans who would pass as white. You can see other disabled groups who can pretend or pass as though they're not disabled. So that oppression exists, and deaf people have experienced it for quite some time.
How have oralism and eugenics been codified into law or other institutions in this country?
The first eugenics law in America was in 1907 in Indiana, and it was a sterilization law. And from that point on, I think our last law that was on the books was in, I may be wrong with the specifics, but it went first quite well into the 20th century. And those laws, most of the time, were pretty broad, which then left room for including almost anybody that didn't fit whatever normalcy was defined at the time.
Can you explain what you referred to as a sterilization law?
So the law in Indiana, for example, most of the time applied to inmates, prisoners, and they would be sterilized. As it applied to deaf people or other groups, the sterilization intent was to prevent offspring. So Bell, going back to Alexander Graham Bell, he pushed for a marriage law that would ban deaf people from marrying one another, because at that time it was felt if two deaf people married, they would have deaf offspring. Now, the science doesn't necessarily fit that reality, what was seen, but most, because 95% of deaf people have hearing parents, but that was the pressure at the time.
How have laws like that been removed or repealed? Have there been like heroes in a struggle for equality that we should be knowing about and celebrating?
I don't know if there were heroes, because you have to remember that the target of these laws were people on the margins of society. One example of a deaf situation, a guy named Junius Winston. He was a deaf black man in North Carolina who was to be sterilized. And that's almost like two strikes against him. One, he was deaf, and he was black, and third, he was poor. So there's not a lot of hero stories here. A lot of people who were targeted were also had mental issues. So society generally didn't recognize them as heroes, but states like California, Virginia, North Carolina, all of those state legislatures have apologized to those who were harmed during those periods and made some reparations in some cases.
Who has done the pushing for those reparations?
So a lot, I mean, that's a good question, and I'm not exactly sure, but a lot has been from within, but different groups like historical groups and individuals themselves. Junius Winston, for example, lived his whole life in an institution, and his case just so happened to be found by an attorney, and that attorney chased it to freeing him from that institution. By the time it happened, he was in his 70s and couldn't really leave the institution anyway. So
yeah. Well, I have read about a pretty significant movement around deaf people pushing for the right to take the civil service exam. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, that was in the early part of the 20th century. And the largest employer of deaf people today is the federal government. And at some point, the government decided to not allow people to take the civil service exam. You had to be able to hear to take the exam. And through the National Association of the Deaf, our NAACP, so to speak, they fought to have that law or rule repealed, and that the Teddy Roosevelt was the president at the time who supported that removal and allow deaf people to take the exam.
What did that victory represent to the deaf community? It seems like an important milestone.
Employment, absolutely. And that's what most deaf people wanted. They wanted employment was key. Today, probably the largest group of unemployed people are people with disabilities in general. If I remember the numbers right, only about 10% of people with disabilities in America have a job. 90% are unemployed, but could work with appropriate accommodations.
I want to turn back to Debbie Buchholz on both the history we've been hearing about, but also the future for this struggle for rights. She's, as you'll recall, the co-founder of Deaf International. She's also the pastor at Deaf International Community Church. And she talked to us earlier about growing up with deaf parents. Her son is also deaf. And Debbie, how are things different for your son than they were for your parents?
So much difference. My son graduated, received a bachelor's degree. He received a master's degree. He's studying now for a second master's degree and wants to pursue a PhD. And so opportunities have opened up so much more than when my father was younger. It's not over though. I just want to make that clear. In my opinion, it's not over. I believe that people in the minority will have to fight probably for the rest of their life, but that it's critical not to give up, but to keep fighting, because everyone has a right to receive the same things. And so it's important for people to realize that this is, it's not over. Even though it's better, it's not over.
Tell me how you and your son are still fighting today.
Well, mostly, again, education. And like the professor mentioned, job opportunities. There's so many deaf people that want to work. So many deaf people who are criticized for not having a job. And they're actually looking and they're applying within, and they're being turned down because just that piece of being deaf scares employers. And so they want to work and they are looking for positions. And if the accommodations were right and proper, they would all be able to work.
Reverend Debbie Buchholz, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And William Ennis, historian with us from Gallaudet University, thank you.
Thank you.
This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're listening back to some favorite interviews from our archives. In just a few minutes, Stefan Singleton, a Kansas City-born singer-songwriter. We'll revisit that conversation as he prepares to drop a new album that's been 8 years in the making. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. You're listening to KCUR's Central Standard, and this is a song called Unworthy by Kansas City's Stefan Singleton.
Too much of this, too much of that. Do a text too much, cause you don't text me back. Got me. Do I say enough? Do I care too much? Am I out of luck? You never miss me much.
I love it. Stefan is hitting his stride here in Kansas City, and it sounds to us like he could make it bigger than that any day, so we're dedicating the rest of today's show to hearing his story. Hi, Stefan.
Hello.
Tell me about this song.
So being Black is hard, and being gay and Black is really, really tough. I went to Catholic school my entire life, and so I wasn't really able to explore or experience love or flirting or the gay community until way later in my life. And so being a late bloomer in that respect, there was a lot of insecurity and there was a lot of feelings of unworthiness. And I fell for a lot of different guys, which is the story of my life, and it didn't work out. You know, just not fitting that stereotypical white, ripped, queer as folk kind of just image, I think, that people have in their minds of falling in love with. I just met a lot of adversity, you know, and I still meet that, you know.
The opening line is too much of this, too much of that.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. Because sometimes you feel like you are too much of this or too much of that. Maybe I'm calling too much. Maybe I'm texting too much. Maybe I didn't text the right thing at this time. Or maybe, you know, maybe I'm completely delusional and this person doesn't even like me. I'm someone that's self-aware and very analytical. And I kind of definitely go there.
You grew up in Kansas City, Kansas. Tell me about your childhood and yeah, the family that raised you.
Well, I grew up in Wyandotte County, which is the poorest county in Kansas. And so I grew up in a relatively poor neighborhood. My parents always provided, my grandparents always provided and made sure that we were taken care of. But I saw a lot of examples of people maybe not reaching the dreams that they really wanted to reach. And my mom was always very supportive, is still very supportive, my grandparents. And they always pushed me to really be everything that I possibly could be and more and kind of strive beyond that. So I really had these great examples, these really strong examples of these women who persevered no matter what. And
women in particular?
Women in particular, yeah. My dad, God rest his soul, wasn't really around. I don't think he really knew how to be a dad at that time. And so I spent a lot of time with my grandmother and my mom and hearing their wisdom and hearing their struggles and listening to a lot of Mary J. Blige in my mom's car and a lot of strong females. And that really kind of captivated me and still captivates me and really helped me kind of push forward and never give up on my dream.
How did you start singing? You've got such a distinctive voice. People compare your voice to Prince or to Billie Holiday, very different frames of reference. But I hear that, but you've got your own thing going on.
Yeah, I was just like a little kid. I think we were like close to the front row, and this choir director at my church, Blessed Sacrament, Pat Fernandez, she heard me sing, and she had this solo in Jacob's Ladder and invited me up, and I had no fear at like 6 or 7, so I just got up and wailed out this solo, and I joined this choir of probably 30-plus year-olds, and I was in it throughout high school, and so I learned about, you know, vocal parts and solos and singing, and that was kind of my first introduction, really.
So you got into music at church. Had you been already exposed to a ton of music outside of church, or was the listening to Mary J. Blige yet to come?
Oh, no, absolutely. No, music was a part of everyday life. My mom would start cooking, she would light some incense, and she would turn on music. So it was Mary J. Blige, but it was also R. Kelly. It was the Isley Brothers. It was Luther Vandross. It was Patti LaBelle. It was Phyllis Hyman, Michelet, D'Angelo, Jill Scott. We had Barbra Streisand records. We had Billie Holiday. We had Prince. So whether it was in the car, whether it was at home, whether it was a vinyl, a cassette, We always, 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 always had music.
And you started recording music in high school. That's pretty early. Tell me what that was like.
It was amazing. I knew from a very early age what I wanted. And what I wanted was to touch the most people possible with music. Music was this magical thing for me, and it still is this magical thing. And so reading liner notes, you know, when I'm like 10 years old, which no one does, and, you know, looking up producers and wanting to understand that world and be in that world, and seeing those music videos on MTV, you know, seeing Kurt Cobain, you know, seeing Smells Like Teen Spirit on TV, just like really captured me and captivated me. So the first thing I wanted to do was get into the studio as soon as I possibly could. So I would borrow money from my grandma, and I would go to these late night sessions at Chapman Recording when it was still downtown. And my mom would drop me off and pick me up, and I would keep on going year after year and just recording things.
You crowdfunded a 2015 album called Caged Bird Sings Songs About Redbeard. And that, those references that you're making, like the caged bird sings, can you talk to me about how you identify with, I don't know, like Maya Angelou or something like that?
Well, I remember reading that book in high school, and it really, the raw honesty of it, and also her very graphic experiences really inspired me. I think even reading stuff like The Scarlet Letter and all of those really like literary, super descriptive narratives influenced me as a songwriter. And also, I really love long titles. And so when that Fiona Apple album came out, When the Pond Hits, and it's like this big long poem, I was really inspired by that. And being a caged bird for me is something that I've kind of felt like my whole life. I'm more of an introverted person. Like I said, I was a late bloomer. And so in Falling in Love, and kind of the thing that started the writing of this album, this guy to me really just wanted my heart for my heart's sake and wanted my attention for my attention's sake. He wasn't really concerned about me or that reciprocation. And so being a caged bird, if the cage is open, you can fly away at any time, right? But I chose to stay within that cage, and I chose to sing about this guy. And also there's nautical references, like I think a pirate just takes to take, right? And so I think that is a lot of what that title represents, but it represents, you know, so much more. That's the beautiful thing about art. You can kind of take what you want from it.
Let's listen to another one of your songs, okay? It's called Hide and Seek, and then we'll talk about it.
Let's do it.
Your creative process?
My creative process is just rolling around in life. and then one day I'll wake up, and if I feel a melody, if I feel lyrics, I'll grab my notepad and my pen and I'll just start writing. Most of it's in my head. I went to college for music, so I can notate things. So sometimes I'll sit at a piano, and that's where some of these songs came from. But generally for me, it's always lyrics and melody first, always.
Talk to me about the production aspect of it. This is a really tightly produced sound.
Yeah, Jamie Searle is probably like the greatest person on the planet. He's my best friend, but he is, to me, a musical genius. He is a musical genius arranger, producer, and he was the first person that I met that kind of got my vision, that really understood this song. I played a few chords on the piano for him at my first meeting with him and my friend Andrew Twinter, and he just went right in on his guitar and knew exactly how the song sounded. And the next thing I know, that week we're in the studio with trumpets and strings and all of these different things. And he orchestrated it all. So he just, it was kind of kismet.
You team up with Jamie's band a lot for live shows. The band is My Brothers and Sisters. Tell me about those shows.
Like, I feel like the king of the world every time it happens. Like, this light switch pops on and I am someone else.
Who is that other person?
He is Stefan in his fullness, I think. I think the stage allows me to be vulnerable and be strong and be sexual and be sensual and be angry and be every single thing that I am. I can't even describe it. It's the most incredible thing. And to be affiliated with Jamie and have him with his 12-piece band go on right after my set is a pleasure. And everyone is just, it's just so connected. It feels like we're all a family, even though we're two separate entities, right? We definitely vibe off of each other and vibe off of this really special thing I think that Jamie has found and that I've found throughout my entire life.
What is the role of emotion in music for you?
It's everything. It's the conductor for me.
We've been listening back to a conversation with Kansas City's Stefan Singleton from last summer. Just last week, he sent me a note letting me know he was just about to record the final song on the album he's been working on for 8 years. It's called Caged Bird Sings Songs About Redbeard, and it drops on the 27th of this month. We'll go out on another one of his songs, one we didn't play last time, I Want to Hold Your Hand. You've probably heard the song. This is Stefan's version. Stefan Singleton, and we'll be keeping our ears out for his new album, which drops later this month. That's it for today's show, an archive edition of KCUR's Central Standard. You can get any of our shows at kcur.org/centralstandard and talk to us on Twitter. We are at KCURCST, and I'm at Gina KCUR. Tomorrow, the food critics lead a search for the best tacos in and around Kansas City. We'll visit a spot on Southwest Boulevard known for two different kinds of green salsa, both amazing. This episode of Central Standard was produced by KCUR's Matthew Long Middleton and Coy Duggar. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.